The subject of tonight's shiur is the story of the marble or the flood. And I'd like to see if we can understand it on a deeper level. You can read it on a simplistic level, and the basic idea seems to be that the mankind had sinned and was steeped in corruption, and as a result of that, God, so to speak, regretted that he had created the world, and God determined to destroy the world. Now that makes sense. That itself makes sense, because as we said, God created the world for a purpose. That man should live a certain type of a existence. And since man has free will, he does have the power to bring about his own destruction. Because when he's no longer living in line with his purpose, so then his existence has no merit, has no value in the sight of God. However, if you want to understand, the story of the flood on a deeper level, then you have to read what happens after the flood. So basically, we're going to be referring tonight to the situation before, prior to the flood, and after the flood. I guess that's antediluvian and post-diluvian, if you like fancy words. Because it's only if you read what happens afterward that you have access to the deeper ideas of what's going on. So let's begin with that. And as I read, you might, if you read it critically, notice some of the problems. What happens after the flood? Noah emerges from the ark when God gives him permission to do so. And the first thing that Noah does when he's on the ground is that he builds an altar. He builds an altar and he brings sacrifices to God. You know that he had brought animals onto the ark with him. Everything that's existing is only a result of what he brought on the ark with him. So it doesn't tell us why. God does not command him to bring a sacrifice. He seems to be doing it of his own volition, and it's not clear the context as to what's motivating this new sacrifice. And God responds, and the Torah over here uses what would have to be regarded as anthropomorphic language. It says that God smelled the pleasant aroma. Of course, that's not to be taken literally. It means that it found favor. But of course, the Torah speaks in the language of man. And God said in his heart, I shall no longer curse the earth because of man. Now listen carefully to the words. Very important expression. Ki yetzer lev ha'adam ra min urav. For the inclination of the heart of man is evil from youth. That's a very, very controversial kind of a statement. It lends itself to misinterpretation. As a matter of fact, it has been misinterpreted by a major religion for the last 2,000 years. And I will no longer continue to smite all living beings as I've done. For the rest of the days of the earth, seed time and harvest and cold and heat and summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. So God, it would seem from this that God is making a promise that he'll never again, it's the result of the fact that he brought the sacrifice, that he'll never again do what he has just done. That he'll never again allow the earth to be destroyed. Now, this is something which is very pleasing when you read it. It sounds like it's... The problem is we project our own emotions onto God. It's a big mistake. But reading it as a human being, it's reassuring. But there's a problem. There's a very deep problem with this. If you put that aside, you begin to study it analytically, this statement is extremely difficult. Let me explain why. Because let's ask a simple question. When God at first did enact a decree against the generation, brought the world to complete destruction, except for Noah, was that an expression of divine justice, or was it not? Was it the right thing to do, or was it the wrong thing to do? Now, I'm operating on the premise that God is perfect. Hatzur tamim po'olo, the rock, his work is perfect. Tichol derach of mishpat, for all of his ways are justice. That God is a faithful God and there's no defect in God. That's the foundation of foundations, that whatever God does is just. He may not always be able to understand it. If that's the case, it seems to me that I can accept the idea of the flood. To me, it adds up. I don't know all the particulars, but if that's the case, if God created man for a purpose, and man fouls up, and he has the capacity to do so, and he's living a totally corrupt existence which has no value as far as God is concerned, so he deserves to be destroyed. So that's why God destroyed him. So now why is God... It seems as though there's an element of regret over here, that God... This is possible for a human, a ruler, because we're imperfect, and we do a lot of things, we're not sure, and we have no choice. But then after doing it, we sometimes have regret. Sometimes when you punish, you take action, and you bring about, or if you're a leader of a country, you go to war against another country, and you bring about tremendous devastation, which makes sense when you're doing it, but afterwards you think it over and you regret. And then you decide you won't do it again. That's okay for a person, but how can this be true of God? I mean, why is God saying that he'll never do it again? What if the same situation, God is not saying over here that the same situation won't arise again? God is merely saying that he's not going to do that again. So why? What if mankind, take a look at the history of mankind, there are certain some generations, it would seem, that come close to, you know, filling the description of the flood, the generation of the flood. Whether that's the case or not, it seems to me that this should be a permanent thing. That it should be a lesson to mankind that if mankind ever does reach that level of corruption, then they deserve to be punished. So why is God saying he'll never do it again? That's the question. When I read it superficially, you sort of get that feeling. I'm agreeing that it's not, but that's my question. Yes. Okay, I'm sorry. I know that some people understand it. But that's not what he's saying here. He's saying, I'll no longer destroy the world. It wasn't... Also, why... That's what Paro said. Paro, by the way, that's why Paro felt confident, according to the rabbis, that he, the decree to cast the male children into the Nile, because he felt confident that God had said that he wouldn't destroy the world through water. But that's not the idea. It's not stated that way. And, I don't know anybody that takes it that way, because what difference does it make? What's the significance of saying that I won't destroy the world through water, I'll find a different way? I mean, what difference does it make? So, that's my first question then. Yes?
I'm thinking perhaps in a couple of ways. One thought that I have is that perhaps it would influence man's behavior, and perhaps in some way God wouldn't want man's behavior to be influenced in that way. If any way it would influence, for instance, the free will of man, by realizing there's such a significant consequence, would it influence man's behavior on a day-to-day basis in some way that God might not want to influence in that way?
And therefore, why
would that be the reason for that saying that I will never do this again?
But the reason why he did it was because mankind deserved it; that their existence had no value.
I'm not disputing that.
Okay.
I agree that he did it because man deserved it.
But wait a minute, let me just clarify something. It's more than that. When you think about it, it has to be that way. Forget about what I said before. The point is even stronger. It's not saying that man deserves it, therefore he has to get it, you know, as we understand. It means, it must be, if you understand fundamentals of how God works, that God's perfection demands that everything he creates has to be for a purpose. And if it doesn't have a purpose, then it can't exist. Because God's a perfect creator, and he can't allow something to exist which has no purpose. That would be a defect in God. So what takes place in the flood is not that God gets angry and says, I'm fed up with you and you deserve it. It has nothing to do with deserving. It's a reality, which stems from the perfection of God. If that's the case, if this should ever occur again, if mankind should ever descend to that level again, so then how could you thwart God? I mean, it's an impossibility. Man can't exist if he's not fulfilling the purpose. That would mean to say that God would be a failed creator, if one can imagine such a thing. The idea of man living in a corrupt state, which was not intended to be, and it exists only because of the will of God, who created him for a purpose, would mean to say that God did not achieve his objective. And by the way, that's the whole... I wasn't intending to go into it tonight, I'll just throw out a little hint. That's the whole concept of Yemos HaMashiach. Why there must be a... Yemos, an era of the Mashiach, when mankind will achieve its objective, a state of perfection for mankind, must be, because it means to say that we're in an imperfect state right now, and that's That's something which is contrary to the nature of things. So God, so to speak, will tolerate that up to a certain point. But there must be a point in time when every aspect of the creation achieves its objective. Otherwise, God is a, so to speak, quote-unquote, failed creator. Anyways, let me proceed. Let me proceed because I have a... Yeah, maybe... Yeah.
You said you wouldn't wipe out the world.
The world, yeah.
Not just men.
Yeah, the whole world. Well...
But you will still punish men.
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure. For sure. Yeah. That's for sure. That's true. Well, that wasn't God that did that. Excuse me, that was man. That's not whether it was right or wrong, that was done by people. That was done by people. Yeah, that wasn't by God. One second. But the point is correct. That's a good point. Now, that strengthens the point. God is not saying he won't punish sinners. We do, well, we can soon be reading about a case in point, which is Sodom and Amara. Wiped out. Completely wiped out. The sin of Sodom is great, and their pride, and so forth. So you see what God is doing, the same thing to them that he did to the generation of the flood. Now, it's on a smaller scale. It's not all mankind. But the way I understand it is because the rest of mankind was not as corrupt. So you see that this principle of punishment must be in effect. It must be. You can't expect it to be otherwise. Oh, it operates differently with the Jewish people because we're in a different relationship with God. But this has to be the way it is. So then it's difficult for me. The question is, why is God saying this? That's my first question. Well, let me proceed. Now, the reason that God gives, listen to this. What's the reason? Because the inclination of his heart is evil from youth. Now, aside from the fact that we don't understand what that means, well, what does that mean? Is it saying that man is evil by nature? Which is totally contrary to our view. That's the basic Christian view, which we can't accept such a notion. And if you can't accept that, obviously, that doesn't make sense, and there's no point of a Torah. You can't have a Torah if man is evil by nature. I mean, how can man be evil by nature since God created him? But I'm not going to go into all the theological arguments why we can't accept that position. But listen carefully. So this is the reason. For whatever it means, and I'll try and explain it later on, this is the reason why man can't be destroyed. Because his inclination of his heart is evil from nature. Okay, so that's why he can't be destroyed. Listen carefully. But what was the reason that God decided to destroy them in the first place? So we'll go back to the pasuk almost word for word. If you go back, we're going back now to Bereishis, which describes the progression of the evil of man as it develops. Because, as we said on Shabbos, it went through a developmental phase. And then it says that God saw, this is the end of Bereishis, that the evil of man had increased in the land. Now listen to the words in Hebrew. V'chol yetzer machshavos libo, rak kol hayom. And all of the inclinations of the thoughts of his heart were only evil all the day. Now this sounds pretty much the same as the first statement. That is the inclination, the same basic idea. The inclination of man's heart was evil from youth, therefore I won't destroy him. Here it's saying, God saw that kol yetzer machshavos libo, all the inclinations of his heart were only evil all the day. And what's the conclusion? Then God regretted that he had made the man, and God was, so to speak, upset by Yisate Velibo, was depressed about it, so to speak, but this doesn't mean it in the emotional sense. And God said, I will wipe out the man that I created from the face of the earth, from man to beast, all the insects and the birds of the heaven, for I regret that I have made him. Then it says, no, it's not a favor. So that very same idea, on the one hand, it's saying that the inclination of man is evil. That's what both psukim are saying, the same basic idea, with very slight variation. In the first case, it's saying that the inclination of man is evil, and therefore I'm going to destroy him. In the second one, it's saying I'm not going to destroy him. Why? Because the inclination of his heart is evil from youth. That's why I won't destroy him. So it seems to be a contradiction in terms. It looks like it's warm here. You want to read up? Okay, that's the second. I have two questions. That's this really, ideally you should have four questions in this year, you know. But I don't know if I have four. Yeah, because it's the four questions. Okay. So the third question, after the flood, as I said, he first comes off and he brings a sacrifice. But what you find is that there are a number of changes. A number of changes occur after the A number of changes occur after the flood, after Noah emerges. Significantly, you have basically what seems to be a new covenant. A new covenant between man and God. And what's the reason for that? Whatever covenant existed between God and Adam should continue to exist right now. Why is there a need for a new covenant? Of course, you know the sign, and God even establishes a specific symbol, the covenant of the rainbow. And whenever you see there, and God says that he's designating the rainbow to be the sign of this covenant. And it's part of this idea that he's never again going to destroy mankind. And when he sees the rainbow, so this will be a reminder, so to speak. So that's a very difficult kind of an idea. Because why is there even a need for a new covenant? And why is there even a need for the rainbow? What is the significance, if we can understand that? And why is the rainbow? God did not create the rainbow at this point. The rainbow existed from creation. It's just that God is now designating, selecting something to be the sign, the reminder. So of course, if that is the case, there must be something specific about the rainbow, which is very, very fundamentally related to what's happening over here, so that it should serve as the basis. But of course, we don't understand what's going on over here, why you need a whole new covenant. You see that God also makes a change in terms of what? A very significant change in terms of giving him permission to eat meat. That's specific, and that's very open in the parsha, that Adam did not have permission to eat meat. See, he was a vegetarian. And now Noah is being given permission to eat meat. Of course, that requires an explanation. All these things are interconnected. There must be some kind of a rationale behind this. And, of course, once that's given, then he's given the command. The command that he's not to partake of what's called Eva Menachai. That means that you can't tear off a limb from an animal. And that this is to say that you have to kill the animal in a humane way. Non-Jews don't have to do a shechita. We have to do a shechita, but even they are not permitted to tear a limb, to practice cruelty to. That's basically practicing cruelty to animals. That's one of the seven Noahide laws. Interestingly enough, I'm sure there's something that must have, or might have, I shouldn't say that, might have missed your attention. Another change, can anybody think of this? Another change that occurs in the scheme of things after the flood, after Noah emerges from the flood. Well, it's not, you don't have your chumash in front of you, so I have an advantage. But it's, you got to read the psukim very, very carefully, as I keep emphasizing. You want to really get the hidden story, the real story of what's going on. And it says that God tells him that the fear of man I'm going to place upon the animals. That's an interesting kind of a thing. It's what it says openly. The fear of you and the dread of you, two words, the fear and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every bird of the heavens and everything that moves on earth and in all the fish of the sea, in your hand they are given. Now, that's referring to something that I think everybody is pretty familiar with, that there's a natural fear of man and animals. And that's why if people go camping, people are going to the outdoors, bears, for example, they always warn you, don't feed the animals. Don't feed the bears. Whenever you read about places where there are bear attacks, that's because they've lost their natural fear of man. And all that seems to be true of all animals. I mean, there's always exceptions, but in general, this is what the Torah is saying. And that's a result of God, that God brought this about. Of course, we don't know how, but God is the creator. So God implanted in animals a certain natural fear of man, and as long as man, of course, it can be broken down. As long as man doesn't do things that would tend to break it down, like you become friendly with them, and you feed them, so then they lose their fear of you. And then they can attack. But other than that, in a general sense, they tend to stay away. People, you can go hiking, It's very rare. It's very, very rare that in an area where people have not been too friendly to the animals, that they're going to attack a person. So, of course, the question really arises is, this would seem not to have been the case prior to the flood. Why is this necessary at this point in time? If that's the scheme of things, we can understand it, because today we have more sophisticated ways of defending ourselves. There was a point, obviously, when Adam, before mankind developed tools and weapons, so then they were at the mercy. They were living closely with the animals. They were at the mercy of the animals. And you do see, now, when you think about it, you see that God brought all the animals to Adam, and Adam was engaged in naming all the animals. So obviously, to name them, he had to get close to them to study them. As we said, it was classification. So how did he protect himself from them? So apparently, he didn't have to worry. And that's before our, isn't that interesting? That's before this special fear was placed in them. So this becomes very, very complicated now. Because first of all, what brought about the need for this at this particular point in time? And secondly, you must assume that it didn't exist beforehand. If it didn't exist beforehand, how can we read about the fact that he mingled with all the animals? How did Noah bring all the animals aboard the ark and not have to be concerned? They didn't bother him. And there was no fear implanted in the animals at that point in time. These are some words I'm going to have to again ask for forbearance. I'll try and go through the points and then I'll take questions. But let me proceed, and then if you have a good question, no problem, we'll write it down. I have paper if anybody wants to borrow. Okay, those are my questions. Those are the three questions. So now let me just review some of the points we made on Shabbos, and I'm going to try and give the exposition. We said that the flood was the result of the sin of mankind. And in general terms, we said that there were two aspects to the sin. The first, it began with the loss of restraint. There was something which brought about an increase in the power of the sexual instincts. And then man broke down all the barriers. As we said, they took wild women from whatever they saw. Things I guess you would call rape and taking other people's wives. The entire breakdown of all of the restraints. That was one aspect of it. And that led to a different element, the element of oppression and corruption in terms of relations, violence between man and man. The element of greed, of theft, a complete breakdown in the system, societal order. And the two are interconnected. Because when God speaks to Noah to tell him about the decree, he says that an end of all flesh has come before me, for the world is filled with this violence and this oppression. And behold, I'm going to destroy the earth. So, as we explained, the increase in the sexual conduct and the breakdown of the barriers in and of itself was a bad development, but when did it reach its ultimate effect was when it distorted his capacity to live a civilized life. As long as he was able to maintain the foundations of civilized existence, that you have to have a certain system of order, you have to have laws, and so forth, he still didn't warrant destruction. But when it reached the point where it destroyed the mental faculty and the ability to live a rational, civilized existence, at that point in time, it's no longer human existence. Now, the question is, what was the underlying cause? Can we find what brought about this entire development? What was responsible for this development? Why did man reach such a state of corruption, of indulgence, of self-indulgence, in all of the instinctual indulgences, and to give in, to give vent to all of his aggressiveness and his selfishness and his greed? What's it about? It could happen, but is there some factor that we could point to? So there's an interesting idea. If you study the Parshios carefully, you'll see that there was a very significant difference in the nature of man, in the nature of man, mankind, that includes men and women, just mankind, before the flood, as opposed to after the flood. For example, in describing this development, The pasuk makes it when God first notices the increase in the sexuality, the instinctuality, and God says that my spirit shall not contend in man because he's flesh, and his days will be 120 years, which means that God always, that means that, not that the human lifespan is 120 years, it means that God is giving mankind 120 years to correct itself. Then it mentions that the giants were in the land, the giants, Nephilim. So it refers cryptically to some race of people that were extremely gigantic and powerful. And what is the relevance over here? And then it says, and even after, it refers to these giants as the sons of God. The sons of God, the sons of rulers. That the implication is that there was a race of extremely mighty individuals. Now, is there any other fact that you could think of, and this is something that you all know, it's something that I wonder how you react to, relate to this fact. Is there any fact from Bereshit that would lend credence, that would support this idea that mankind was an extremely physically powerful state? Much, much different. That pre-diluvian man was a totally different type of a creature.
They lived so long.
Exactly. That's something that most people can't relate to. And made me entertain a certain amount of doubt about that. You see that basically they lived almost 2,000 years. It's all of the genealogies, the lifespans are well into the... Hanoch was 300 and...
Even the shortest is 365.
365, and that's considered to have been an exception. They died young. He only lived 365 years. That's why the Torah has to point out that Kilokachos, that God took him. And that's an interesting idea, why God took him. Before his time. He was only 365, he was just beginning. He was just starting out. But no, but after the flood, you see that there is a gradual diminishing. Abraham was 175. And it keeps getting, Moshe Rabbeinu was 120. So it's certain exceptional people. David HaMelech was 70 years old, but in the time already of Tanakh, in the time of David HaMelech, that's basically our lifespan. So what's going on? How do you account for that? It's difficult for people to relate to something. I think many people question this, those who are not absolutely committed to believing in the truth of the Torah, because it's really a blow to our narcissism, because we feel that we're modern. The modern person always feels that he's superior to all the generations that preceded him. There's a certain feeling of superiority. By the mere fact that we're alive and they're dead, that's a certain emotion. It's a crazy emotion. And we feel that this is the best time to be alive, because we have all these technological things that they didn't have, so therefore why? Because we're superior to that. So God, they were there, they had to be there all along to pave the way so that we can come along because enjoy these things, because we're the really important people. But you see, so that's really a blow, because they lived 960 years, so how could it be that there are other people before us that had something superior that we didn't have? So that's why people have a tough time with it. But it's part of the Torah. Now, there's another statement of Chazal, that Chazal meaning the Talmudic scholars. It's a fascinating statement, and if you understand this, you'll understand the key to the entire story of the flood. Rabbi Yitzchak said, what caused this generation to rebel against God? Is it not because they would plant and they would not reap except for 40 years? That means they have to plant once in 40 years. That is to say that the nature of the agricultural situation was such, it was in such a perfect state that you'd plant once and you'd have enough, it would last, for the supply would last for 40 years.
Is it possible that those 40 years is always 1 year?
No. I mean, there's no indication. He's talking, this is in time of the Talmud, so he doesn't mean that. Listen, and also when it records the years, it's our years. They lived over 900 years in terms of, you know, what we consider to be a year. And he says they would travel from one end of the world to the other end of the world in a very short period of time. And they would be able to pluck up cedars, mighty cedars of Lebanon, as they walked along. And lions and leopards would would be like little fleas to them. They'd be like nothing to them. What's the reason for this? Because of the very good atmospheric conditions, and so on and so forth. There's many statements along these lines. What he's telling us is what I've been alluding to over here, that pre-diluvian man was physically constituted in a manner which is completely different than what we're accustomed to. That's what he's saying. That they were the... If you, I was to ask you, what is the most powerful animal in the animal kingdom? Maybe the lion, the elephant, I don't know. That's now. If the question were to be raised in that time, the answer would be Adam, man. God created man to be the most powerful being from a physical standpoint. He towered in terms of his power, head and shoulders above all the animals, because the way God had set up the entire system, the entire ecosystem, with all of the foods that were in effect at the time, that were, the fact that he would travel from one end of the world to the other end of the world in a short period of time, that doesn't have to be taken literally. It means that he had tremendous speed, tremendous endurance, tremendous capacity, and he would lift up, he could pick up mighty cedars, uproot them with his hands. That itself doesn't have to be taken literally. That's an allusion to the tremendous physical strength, unimaginable physical strength that he had. And that's what caused him to rebel.
Well, they actually tell you how tall these people are in a roundabout way, because they tell you that the Og, the king of Bashan, was a refugee from those people, and they actually give you the measurements of his death.
That's Og, yeah. Okay, but where... Okay, it's a good point. The specifics over here is hard. We don't know how tall and all of those things. So you have to understand the idea in a general way. But given that they lived almost to 1,000 years, you have to understand that you're dealing with a different type of a creature that was entirely different. Now, what was the reason for that? And how does that affect the state of corruption? Well, the reason is because that was a tov. That was a good that God gave to man. That there's a relationship, of course, as you know, between the physical constitution and one's mental and spiritual capabilities. That's why the Rambam says the obligation to take care of one's body, to guard one's health. It's not because health is an end in itself. Because he says a person cannot serve God properly if he's in a state of illness. Because you have to have all of the emotional energy, the psychological energy, all of this stems from the fact you're a physical being. Now, the stronger a person is, the more energy he has, the more power he has, the more capacity he has. So he was created with a tremendous amount of power and capacity that we can't even imagine. We can't relate to it because we're after the flood. Now, why? That was a tov. Because he was the work of God's hand. God created him and constructed him in a manner that he should reign complete. That's why and have dominion over all the animals. That's what it says in Bereshit. He was supposed to do that in order to achieve an existence in which he'd be able to have the things that he needed with ease, without having to work too hard, and but even more significantly, to have the type of mental capabilities and power that if he used it properly would be to the service of God, would place him on a much higher level. Because the weaker a being is, the more sickly he is, and so on and so forth, the more difficult an existence, and the less energy, the less capacity he has to redirect his energies to involvement in the good, which of course involves a tremendous amount of effort in terms of obtaining knowledge and wisdom and redirecting his energies and reaching a certain level of closeness to God. This demands a tremendous amount of power and energy. But he has free will, so he corrupted himself. That's always the case. Whenever a person is the beneficiary of a tremendous good, instead of thanking God for the good, he takes the credit himself. He takes the credit himself. It went to his head. He became so enamored of himself. When a person is a... You see people that have natural beauty, have natural strength. Very often it goes to their head. And they have this self-image of being supremely powerful. That's what it means over here. He rebelled against God because they reached such a state of, it's called hubris, such a state of pride and confidence. He was so powerful that he had no need for God. See, Judaism maintains that the self-image of a person is determinative. We've made this point many times, that if a person has a self-image of being a conqueror, of being a ruler. Then, see, that you can see it in the lives of many people. That sometimes people that are living a disciplined life, controlled, modest, as soon as they achieve some type of a tremendous success or they become extremely wealthy, then it goes to their head. Now they're extremely important and they can't deny themselves anything. This is the basic idea over here of what the Parsha is talking about. That man was sort of trapped. He could not pull himself out of the evil that he had gotten into, because he was so strong and so confident and so powerful that there was nothing that could pull him away from that, the arrogance that he developed. So therefore, just as we said last week, after Adam and Eve had eaten from the fruit and they had changed their nature, the natural drive was only towards the instinctual, and they had to be destroyed, but God came up with a plan, which was to instill conscience, a counterforce against the instincts. So now man had somehow found a way to override the force of conscience. The instinctual was supreme. So once again, we reached a point where mankind was deserving of destruction. And had Noach not found favor in the eyes of God, that would have been the outcome. But instead God found a way, and again this is in the framework of the mercy of God, God found a way of addressing the problem. If that's the case, we have to understand on a deeper level, how would you characterize the flood, the marble? There are two possible ways you can understand the flood. One is the simplistic way that everybody has when they're growing up, when they're learning the story. And that is to say, the world was evil, so God just chose a flood to wipe out all the creatures. And the Noah was saved, and everything goes back to the way it was before. That's the first way. On the basis of what I said now, would you say that that's really what the flood is? Or is the flood much more of a global kind of a phenomenon? You see that it would not have been that the flood goes on for many, many days, for about a year or so, and the Torah describes at great length that all these springs of the earth, there's tremendous climactic changes, atmospheric changes, there's tremendous, Chazal allude to it, they discussed it, the Pasuk allude to it, Chazal explained it, that there's tremendous explosions going on, tremendous changes are occurring. That's much, much more than is necessary just to destroy mankind. There was a different reality. There was a different reality because the flood was not simply an act of destruction, but the flood was two things. It was destruction, and what's the second word? Reconstruction, recreation. There was a fundamental shift. This should not be understood simply as a flood, as destruction, but this is creation too. Because all of the conditions of the first creation have been uprooted, and because Noah found favor, and God wanted mankind to have another opportunity, so God removes the, and recreates the world with completely different set of atmospheric, climactic conditions, which are going to affect everything in the world. But what is the most important, the most drastic, the most blatant effect of all in the new creation? Who emerges from the... Noah is interesting because he spans both. Noah comes from the pre-creation situation, and he also exists in the post-flood situation. The most significant factor in the change is that the being, the Adam, the human that emerges is a weakened being, is physically weakened. And that's the kind of a being that we can relate to. You see it, and that's why the very first, let's go back there and review the question. The very first thing that Noach does when he gets off of the ark, what does he do? He builds an altar, and he offers a sacrifice to God. The Torah does not record that he brought any kind of a sacrifice to God before him. And God did not command him to do so. But this was an expression of a new type of subservience, a new type of recognition. The sacrifice is an expression of the fact that everything that we have, our very existence, is dependent upon God.
But it existed before the flood. That's
what's that?
Cain and Abel brought sacrifice.
That's true, but that was before the corruption that set in. We're talking during the generation of the corruption. See, in order to bring a sacrifice, you have to have a certain amount of humility. A person that feels totally confident in himself and that he doesn't really need God doesn't bring a sacrifice. The very first emotion, Noah was a tzaddik, a righteous person. I'm not saying he would not have brought a sacrifice. He believed in God. But just because you believe in God doesn't mean you're motivated to necessarily bring a sacrifice. But as soon as he gets off the teva, the ark, that's the very first thing he does. So he's overcome by this tremendous sense of weakness. And then what does God, it says that God smelled the pleasant aroma. And God said, because of that sacrifice. That sacrifice was definitive, because that sacrifice that expresses that new element which is causing God to say that he'll never again destroy the world.
Was it possible that he brought
the
sacrifice because he survived the flood, and that's
not his
thanks to God?
That's true. But the need to bring the sacrifice is an expression of this newfound subservience, the awareness that he does not have any existence except for the fact that God's countenance shines upon him. So when it says that God appreciated, God smelled the aroma, it means that God recognized that new element of subservience in man, which is a result of this newfound weakness. And that's what God means when he says, I will no longer destroy mankind. Means to say that I've now placed this condition, this corrective, so to speak. I've corrected the system. And I've created man in such a way that he'll never again reach that level of corruption, because he'll never again have that sense of power that produced that arrogance in the first place because of this newfound weakness. Now, that's, on the basis of that, let's understand the contradiction. Here it says, Ki yetzer lev ha'adam ra min urav, because the inclination of the heart of man is evil from youth. Now, first of all, I said, what does that mean? Does that mean that man is evil by nature? It's evil from youth. But then I said there was a contradiction, because it said beforehand that God saw that the inclination of his heart was only evil all the day. So that seems to be the very same idea. What's the difference between the two? I'm sorry? No. Now, how, in youth. Let me say what I mean. See, rak kol hayom, only evil all the day, is the perfect description of the way that man was before the sin. It was only evil all the day because there was nothing within him to cause him to pause, to cause him to have any type of a fear, any type of a doubt. That was the result of that self-confidence. He was filled with himself because of his power. So God said, since that is the case, there's no point in his existence. There's nothing that's going to prevent him from acting in accordance with his emotions. Now, afterwards it says, that feeling that you can appreciate, by the way, there is a period in your life, I assume, when everybody has the feeling that people had before the flood, that feeling of being supreme, that I'm going to be here forever,
teenager.
What's the term? Teenager. When you're young, right? I'm going to live forever. I'm going to be a that sense of some type of a supernatural power. See, that's when you're young. And when you're young, you have this tremendous sense of strength, and you never get tired, and you feel you can do everything. You can take on the world. That's exactly the way he felt all the day. But now you only feel it when you're young, because God created a new thing that didn't exist before. It's called illness. And people get a little bit older, and they start to get ill, and they start to get weak, and they start to get tired, and then there's diseases. And when you're 30s, your 40s, you have to get arthritis and other things, or a heart condition, and they have cancer, and you're battling, and this breaks down. So this feeling of Yetzer Adam Ra Min Urav, the inclination of man's heart is evil. It's evil in youth, because in youth He's really overcome by this feeling of the instinctual side and the egotistical side, and he's able to sort of maintain it as long as he's young, and some a little bit longer. But you see how these these sports figures or other kinds of heroes in society, they have this tremendous feeling of power, of absoluteness, and then they just get a little bit, they can never imagine themselves being weak. But then they get a little bit older, and God programmed it into the system, so they'll never reach that point. And when you get older, you realize something, and that is to say that you're finite, that you're not going to live forever, that you're mortal, and that you're weak, and that you need God's help. And that's when you don't have too many youngsters asking for Mishnah Berurah on Shabbos, but you do find a lot of the older people. That is part of the new reality that comes into being. So that is basically the real story of the flood. And now you can understand everything else that fits, why there's a need for a new covenant. Because it's a whole new Adam. The old covenant was made with a completely different type of a person. But what emerges is a new type of a being. And he requires a new covenant with God. You'll also understand this idea of the fear, the dread, the fear and dread that animals have of man. Why is that necessary at this point, and why wasn't it necessary before? Because beforehand he was a giant, he was the most powerful of all the creatures, so he had no fear. He was stronger than the animals, so there was a natural situation. Of course the animals were afraid of him by nature, but now God has diminished him and he's not stronger than the animals, so now he could not exist. The animals would destroy him. So therefore God implants at this particular point a fear. It's a natural fear of man and the animals, otherwise he couldn't exist. You'll also understand why now he's given permission to eat meat. Because there's a complete change in terms of the agriculture and that tremendous state of health. There were many factors. It was the atmosphere, it was the nature of the food, and all the other factors. All of these things have been removed, and a completely new situation emerges. In this situation, he's a different kind of creature. He requires meat. And that's why Adam was not given permission to eat meat, and he is given permission to eat meat. And of course, then you have the command that he's not to kill people. It says, the command, Shofet, that anyone who spills the blood of man shall be killed by man. This is something that was not created at this point. Adam was also commanded against murder. Murder was one of the six nullified laws that Adam had. But this is reiterated, because once man is engaged in killing animals, so that's an expression of the aggressive instinct of man, so then there's a warning that it could carry over, that he has to curb the aggression. He has to limit the aggression. It's only against an animal, and he has to do so in a humane way. And God repeats that he may not act out this aggression against the fellow man. And now, of course, you see the need for the covenant of the rainbow. The basic idea is that, imagine yourself, if you had gone through something like the flood, it's very hard to imagine these kinds of things. And even if it's one thing, of course, you're the only person that's saved. But would you have the ability to really get to work and to start plowing the fields and building housing and having children and setting up a life? It's a devastating thing. It's a tremendous blow to man's sense of self-worth. Nothing has worth in the eyes of God. A person can only build something if he feels that there's a certain type of a permanence. He has to feel there's some type of a permanence. Whatever you're doing, whatever you're engaged, when the pioneers came to build up Israel, they did so because they felt that they were engaging in something historical, that this will be here for a long time, hopefully forever. And hopefully it will be forever. But if people have a sense, if people aren't going to really put too much energy into something, they're not going to invest in a neighbor, move into a neighbor, if they feel that in a few years it's going to be gone. There's no point to it. So he had just gone through a devastating experience that everything that we've built, civilizations, were just uprooted. So how do you even get back into the work of being involved in Tikkun Olam? That's what God wants him to do. So God had to reassure him. God had to reassure him that he's never going to do this again. And he wanted him to have a concrete reminder. And that concrete reminder was the rainbow. And I want to, what is the idea of why the rainbow? All right, so it's true, I mean, many of the commentators say, because the rainbow is shaped like an arrow. So when the rainbow appears, it's the arrow, the bow. So the bow is in the opposite direction. That is to say that it's pointed the other way, not pointed at man. The way the bow would appear if somebody was trying to shoot an arrow at you, but the rainbow is the other way. That's the Ramban says that idea. Yeah. Right. I heard, it's not necessary to assume there's only one interpretation, but I heard a brilliant interpretation from Rabbi Chaib, which I want to share with you. And it really goes to the heart of what the entire story is. And that is, he said, that basically the real promise, the real assurance to Noach that this won't happen again is because of what the flood is all about. That God is saying that he's recreated mankind. And he's recreated them in such a way that they'll never reach that level of corruption due to the phenomenon of human weakness. And that now man will experience illness and he'll get old and he'll die. So he'll always be aware of his mortality. So he said, therefore, the flood is the second creation. Now let's analyze. What's the difference between creation 2 and creation 1? Well, if you're familiar with the doctrine of Judaism, creation 1 is called Yesh Me'ayin. That God created the world from nothing. And the philosophical term is ex nihilo, from nothing. That's our idea that only God is eternal, and that God created the matter, the substance, that's called, Yesh Me'ayin. The second creation was not Yesh Me'ayin, it was Yesh Me'yesh. God simply rearranged the substances. So what is the best way to represent the new creation? The new creation is best represented by the rainbow. Because what's a rainbow? What happens? When you take some light and you pass it through a prism of water so it separates into various colors. And then you remove the light and it recombines once again. So that is the perfect representation of the second creation. The second creation is really not creating a new substance, but separation and combination. Separation, a change, to bring about a change in the physical substance of the world, and to recombine. So he said that the rainbow is the perfect vehicle to express that idea. When the rainbow appears, he's saying you'll look at it and you'll remember separation and combination, which is recreation, which is the second creation. And once you see the second creation, then you'll know that my commitment to mankind is never to destroy it. Of course, that's represented by the entire idea. If God intended to destroy mankind, he would have done so as soon as they had sinned in the flood. But God found a way, so to speak, to bring about the conditions. Albeit, there's a price to pay. There's always a price to pay. There was a price to pay when they sinned the first time and God created conscience. Now there's a price to pay in the sense that man is physically limited, cannot do the kinds of things, and therefore can't reach the same type of heights that he would have been able to reach before had he used the gifts properly. But that's the idea.
Is this the kind of genetic engineering?
The second one?
Yeah. I mean, all of the creatures, man included, after the flood are descendants of those that were on the ark. And so, without supernatural interference in the process of genetic inheritance, he has to come out the same as he was before. So if it's a genetic change, it must be like a divine intervention.
There is a divine intervention. The specifics is not easy to, isolate, but it seems to a large extent, it seems to have a tremendous amount to do with the external conditions, with the air, the quality of the air, the quality of the food, the vegetation, the whole cycle. Whether there's any, it's possible, you know, to speculate. The Torah is just describing the results. It's not describing the means, except very in a limited kind of fashion. Now you'll understand the extensive description of what's taking place during the flood, and how the, you know, the ark is bouncing all around, and the springs of the earth are gushing forth and so forth. So, I mean, it's possible. So I just want to conclude that this is the basic idea of the flood on a much deeper level. And it gives us tremendous insight into the cause of most of human folly, which, in spite of everything that God has done for us, in spite of all the changes, I think we all partake of. And that is the sense of being a supreme, the sense of tremendous power, and this unwillingness to recognize that the limited nature of life. And that's the idea, that a person should recognize his weakness and to obtain a certain type of humbleness. And the most important thing to realize is that since we do experience weakness, since we do experience illness, then we should be aware of the fact that of our own mortality, that life is very short, that it's limited. And the point is then not to live with a sense of immortality, and to recognize that the time that has been given to us has been given for a purpose, and that the entire purpose of the physical existence of man is to achieve a certain level of perfection of the soul. And that's the idea, and as long as we're in line with that idea, our existence does find favor with God, and he provides us with the things that we need for our perfection. Okay, if there's any questions, I'd be happy now. Go ahead, Murray.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a point about the flood, the concept of why God would use water to destroy the earth if he could have used most anything else. And it seems to me that the very fact that there's water, which is we need so much for life, he used to destroy life, and thus has another meaning for the people who were involved. So they saw that the very object that they needed to everything they needed for life was reduced to destroy life.
Yeah. When I'm sure that there's truth in that. Whenever God does something, it has meaning on many, many levels. But that's not the primary level. The primary level is that this is not just destroying mankind. Because God could have simply willed them to be destroyed. But God wanted to bring about a change.
He could have used something else. He used fire.
Well, I don't know. This was a day that we don't know what he could have used. And whatever. I mean, there's a point there.
The rainbow represents separating
and being. Right. Separation and combination. That's recreation.
Right. So then it could be a constant reminder that he could always do that again. Because that going to destroy the world, but you could...
Well, always bring about destruction. Yeah. By the way, that's a beautiful analogy. When you remodel your house, what are you doing? You're taking things apart and you're putting them together again with a new form. Just to make it clearer. Yes.
But
he says he'll never do that to the entire world.
Right.
Oh, so that makes perfect sense. So there will be societies that may have to be destroyed. That's justice. Like Sodom and Amora. But the idea of destroying the entire world, because mankind will reach a level where they will no longer be capable of human existence, because there's haughtiness that won't come. Can I be that haughty? Just too weak. I'm sorry. Lisa? Are you raising your
hand?
Oh, I'm sorry. Elliot? You guys can debate.
The question that I have is, God is all knowing.
Yeah.
And that he knew that's going to happen.
What, the corruption?
The corruption and the destruction and the new creation of Yesh Meyesh, etc. Then why?
That question was raised last week, I believe. In a similar vein. Somebody asked me, didn't God know? I think it was...
No, there's something else, though. Here you have a world that was created by an omnipotent God, and a world that was recreated because the first world was not good. What was the point of doing the first world? Meaning, it almost lends itself to the issue of, and I'm not saying it because I believe it, but it does lend itself to the issue of there's something wrong here. If God knew that this is going to happen, then why this development? I want to tell you before I to say, continue, that I've asked that question before. And
to me?
No, not you. I've asked that question before, many years ago. And the answer that I got then was, you're right, this is the time to be ma'amin ben ma'amin in order to understand, in order to actually accept it. Meaning, because whenever we talk about previous worlds that were created, then if you're ma'amin ben ma'amin, then you're accepting it. And if not, then indeed that is one of the issues that puts you into great question.
Well, I'll answer the question briefly. But if that's not satisfactory, if you need, as I said, I think the way I understand it, it's pretty similar to the question. That's a separate, it might require a separate shiur. But I'll just try and answer briefly.
I can't.
I
have so many years of patience I can get to.
Oh, okay. So let me just answer. I'll answer it briefly. And I'll answer it briefly. I don't necessarily agree with that idea that one has to be mamon and so on and so forth for this particular thing. I am not agreeing with the concept that God created a world that wasn't good. The world was very good, and that was the ideal. But you have to understand what it means. We read in Eicha, it says, from the mouth of God does not come forth the blessing and the curse, or something along those lines. I don't know if it's the exact. So what does it mean, from the mouth of God does not come forth the blessing or the curse? We thank God for all the blessings. Exactly. God merely, any good that God gives, that's exactly what Rav Yitzchak was saying. That they only rebelled against me because of a good that I had given them. Because any time God gives you a good, that's a different issue. That's a different issue. But you're raising the question of the conflict that if God knows, so does man really have free will?
No, that's not what I'm saying. That's what I said. That's not my question. My question is, God knew about it. He knew this is going to happen. He knew how it's going to develop. He knew everything from advance. Now, men still had free will. And even the Nephilim had free will to do this evil. But God, when he created the world, or if you wish, before he created the world, he knew exactly how it's going to develop. That's the point. That's the question I'm asking. I'm not wondering the question of free will. That's very clear.
But you're not asking a question.
I'm making
a statement. What's the question?
That's not true. I made a very clear question. It is a very big question. It is the question of how can you believe that this good God, etc., etc. And that's a question I'm placing not because I am doubting the story. It's a question I'm placing because you have to understand that this question is going to be asked by every person who's a thinker who goes through this story. And they ask that question. And as I said, I've asked it before, many years ago. And the answer that I got from the top intellectual in the Jewish field, and truly and certainly a rabbi, and that was the answer, that this is where the emunah comes in.
Lisa, I'm just trying to understand the question.
It's very simple, A.
But I understand. If God knew that this was going to happen, then... And that's the piece that
Why did God create the world altogether? That's another question. Why did he create the world? We know.
Why is God hanging around waiting for the Messiah?
With all due respect, I asked the question.
I'll tell you what.
That does not necessarily need it in an answer. The reason I am, and therefore don't feel that you have to answer
not at all.
And don't feel that you have to answer a question that top rabbinical figures could not answer. So don't feel that you have to do it.
In a forum like this, a person has a right to try and answer. The fact that great rabbis may have said that they couldn't answer it
said that this is where the ma'amin ben ma'amin comes.
That's according to their understanding. And no matter how great you are, somebody else can have a different understanding, and even a lesser person can sometimes come with an answer. Let me address this topic, not tonight. Let me address this in a more, you know. Yeah.
Okay, I can accept the fact that God wanted to punish humanity because of humanity's sin.
Right.
So why do you take it out in the animals?
That's a good point. That's a good point. But it seems that, see, if you're following my premise over here, it's not punishment the way we look at it, like you deserve it, I don't deserve it. It's rather that everything was created for a purpose. And the animals apparently were not created for an independent purpose, but rather to serve man. It's part of the system. Everything in the, under the sun, so to speak, in our framework, it's not that God created man because God wants man to exist, and God created horses because God likes horses or wants horses to exist. But everything in this framework is really subservient to man. So that if there's a change, if man would not exist, then the animals would exist. Doesn't make sense. Okay, I think maybe we'll pause here, and I don't want to keep people too late. It's. What was that? That's a hard thing. As to why God chose a delusion, not another way of doing it.
The point is, to have a rainbow, you have to have moisture. You can't have a rainbow without moisture.
Right.
Moisture in the air, people will recognize right away as a symbol of the flood. So it brings back the idea to people that this is God's way of
I have two different questions. As far as why did God destroy the animals?
Not just the animals, but the land and everything.
I'm trying to say it wasn't just man, but it was the entire system, the entire world as we know it. Everything was changed. Everything, yeah, all the oceans, the seas, the whole ecosystem was changed. That's what I'm trying to explain. Well, the fish, perhaps, whatever, but that's...
I don't understand the difference between...
Do you have a question? Perhaps some refreshments.